must be brought to heel.
Out into the corridor, bustling her mistress along, fussing now at the straps that held the cuirass.
He probably won't fight you anyway. His soldiers will be blinded by the sun shining off your brass boobs. You must be a giantess, they're so huge. They'll be terrified and run away.
The stern-faced officers who awaited her in the entryway to the palace were startled then. Startled and mightily heartened. Appearing before them was the leader of their grim and perilous mission, a woman, and small at that, howling with laughter. As gay a laughter as they had ever heard, at any time, much less on the morning of a battle. They took courage from the thought. Stern faces grew sterner still. And Antonina kept laughing and laughing all the way out to her horse waiting in the courtyard. She wasn't sure what amused her most, the thought of her brass breasts, which made her laugh, or the way her laughter so obviously boosted the morale of her men. Either way, doesn't matter. Out of small victories come great ones. As her army marched through the streets of Alexandria, heading toward the suburb of Nicopolis, where the Roman garrison had been stationed since the early days of imperial rule, Antonina took the opportunity to assess the city's mood. The streets were lined with people, watching the procession. Most of them were Egyptians and poor Greeks. Both were cheering, the Egyptians with loud enthusiasm, the Greeks with more restraint. Word had already spread through the city that Theodosius had been installed as the new patriarch. That news had been greeted by the Egyptian Monophysites with wild acclaim. Theodosius was one of their own. True, he was an adherent of the Severan school, whose moderate and compromising attitude toward the official church was out of step with the more dogmatic tradition of Egyptian Monophysitism. But the Egyptian residents of Alexandria didn't look on these things the same way as the fanatic Monophysite monks of the desert. They had had enough of street brawls and persecution. Doctrinal fine points be damned. The Empress Theodora was one of them, and she had placed another in the Church of St. Michael. Good enough, more than good enough, to declare a holiday. The Greek residents who watched Antonina pass, men cheered her on, took less pleasure in the news. Many of Alexandria's Greek population, of course, had adopted Monophysitism themselves. All of the religious leaders of that dogma were Greek, in fact, even if they found their popular base in the Coptic masses of Egypt. But most Greeks, even poor ones, had remained true to orthodoxy. Still, they were not nobles. Tailors, bakers, linen makers, glassblowers, sailors, papyrus workers. Almost all the Mediterranean world's paper was made in Alexandria. Shopkeepers, merchants, domestic servants, fishermen, grain handlers. The list was well-nigh endless. Some were prosperous, some merely scraped by, but none were rich. All of them, even here in Alexandria, had come to accept the general opinion of the Roman Empire's great masses with regard to the imperial power. That opinion had crystallized in Constantinople itself with the defeat of the Nicaa insurrection. From there, carried by the sailors and merchants who weaved Roman society into a single cloth, the opinion had spread to every corner of the empire. From the Danube to Elephantine, from Cyrene to Trebizond, the great millions of Rome's citizens had heard, discussed, quarreled, decided. The dynasty which ruled the empire was their dynasty. It never occurred to them, of course, to think of the dynasty as a people's dynasty. Emperors were emperors, common folk were common folk. The one ruled the other, law of nature. But they did think of it as theirs, not because the dynasty came from their own ranks, which it did, and they knew it, and took pleasure in the knowing, so much as they were satisfied that the dynasty understood them, and based its power on their support, and kept at least one eye open on behalf of their needs and interests. Common folk were common folk, emperors were emperors, and never the twain shall meet. That still leaves the difference between a good emperor and a bad one, a difference which common folk measure with a different stick than nobility. The taxes had been lowered and made more equitable. The haughtiest nobles and the most corrupt bureaucrats had been humbled, always a popular thing among those over whom the elite lords it, even executed. Wildly popular, that. Stability had been restored, and with it the conditions which those people needed to feed their families. And finally, there was Belisarius. As she marched through the streets, Antonina was struck by how often her husband's name made up the cheer coming from the throats of the Greek residents. The Egyptians, too, chanted his name. but they were as likely to call out her own or the Empress Theodora's. Among the Greeks, one name only. Belisarius! 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 She took no personal umbrage in that chant. If nothing else, it was obvious that the cheer was the Greek's way of approving her as well. She was Belisarius's wife, and if the Greek upper crust had often sneered at the general for marrying such a disreputable woman, it was clear as day that the Greek commoners lining the streets of Alexandria were not sneering at him in the least. The Greeks had found their own way to support the dynasty, she realized. Belisarius might be a Thracian himself and might have married an Egyptian and put his half-Egyptian, half-knows-what-bastard stepson on the throne, but he was still a Greek, in the way which mattered most to that proudest of Rome's many proud nations. Whipped the Persians, didn't he? Just like he'll whip these Malwa dogs, whoever they are. Hermogenes leaned over to her, whispering, "The word of Anatha's already spread." Antonina nodded. She had just gotten the word herself the day before. The semaphore network was still half-finished, but enough of it had been completed to bring the news to Antioch, and from there by a swift Kelej courier ship to Alexandria. There had been nothing personal addressed to her in the report, but she had recognized her husband's turn of phrase in the wording of it, and she had seen his shrewd-minded work in the way he emphasized the decisive role of Greek cataphracts in winning the great victory over Malwa. That word, too, had obviously spread. She could read it in the way Greek shopkeepers grinned as they cheered her army onward, and the way Greek sailors hoisted their drinking cups in salute to the passing soldiers. "Thank you, husband. Your great victory has given me a multitude of small ones." The fortress at Nicopolis, where the army of Egypt lay waiting, was one of the Roman Empire's mightiest. Not surprising. The garrison was critical to the Empire's rule. Egyptian grain fed the Roman world. Constantinople depended upon it almost entirely, and the grain was shipped through Alexandria's port. Since Augustus, every Roman Empire had seen to it that Egypt was secure. For centuries now, the fort at Nicopolis had been strengthened, expanded, modified, built up, and strengthened yet again. "We'll never take it by storm," stated Ashot. "Not with the forces we've got. Even grenades will be like pebbles against those walls." He looked up at the battlements where a mass of soldiers could be seen standing guard. It'd be pure suicide for sappers trying to set charges. Ashot, along with Antonina and Hermogenes and the other top officers of the expedition, was observing the fortress from 300 yards away. Their vantage point was another of the great intersections which dotted Alexandria itself, very similar to the one at the city center, if not quite as large, down to the Tetrastylon. Originally, the fortress had been built outside the city's limits, but Alexandria had spread over the centuries. Today, the city's population numbered in the hundreds of thousands. The fortress had long since been engulfed within the suburb called Nicopolis. It was a bit jarring, actually, the way that massive stone structure, so obviously built for war, rose up out of a sea of small shops and mud-brick apartment buildings. Comical, almost. In the way that a majestic lion might seem comical if it were surrounded by chittering mice. Except that there were no chittering mice that day. The shops were boarded up, the apartments vacant. Nicopolis's populace had fled the moment news came that Antonina was advancing against Ambrose. All morning, a stream of people had poured out of the suburb, bearing what valuables they owned in carts or haversacks. Antonina turned to Hermogenes. "Do you agree?" Hermogenes nodded instantly. "Ashot's right. I know that fortress. I was stationed in it for a few months shortly after I joined the army. You can't believe how thick those stone walls are until you see them." He twisted in his saddle and looked back at Menander. "Could you take it with siege guns? You're the only one of us who's observed them in action." Seeing himself the focus of attention, the shy young cataphract tensed. Yet there was no faltering or hesitation in his reply. "Yes, I could if we had them. But John told me just yesterday that he doesn't expect to produce any for months. Even then, it'd take weeks to reduce those walls." Very shyly now. "I don't know as Antonina can afford to wait that long." "Absolutely not," she said firmly. "The longer this drags on, the more likely it is that revolt will start brewing in other parts of Alexandria. The rest of Egypt, for that matter. Paul has plenty of supporters in every one of the province's Greek towns all the way up to Ombos and Syene, just below the first cataract." Antonopoulos and Oxyrhynchus are hotbeds of disloyalty, not to mention... She fell silent. The top officers surrounding her knew the strategic plan which she and Belisarius had worked out months earlier to carry the fight to Malwa's exposed southern flank. But the more junior officers didn't. Antonina had no reason to doubt their loyalty, but there was still the risk of loose talk being picked up by Malwa's spies. So she bit her tongue and finished the thought only in her mind. Not to mention that I don't have weeks, months to waste in Alexandria. I've got to get to the Red Sea and join forces with the Axumites. By early spring of next year at the latest. And the next one, full of anguish. Well, my husband, if he's not already, will be a dead man. But nothing of that anguish showed in her face. Simply calm resolution. No, gentlemen, we've got to win this little civil war quickly. Ashot tugged his beard and growled, I'm telling you, it'll be pure slaughter if we try to storm that place. Antonina waved him down. Relax, Ashot, I'm not crazy. I have no intention of wasting lives in a frontal attack, but I don't think it's necessary. Hermogenes, too, was tugging his beard. The siege will take months, a year probably, unless we get siege guns. That fortress has enough provisions to last that long easily, and they've got two wells inside the walls. Antonina shook her head. I wasn't thinking of a siege, either. Seeing the confusion in the faces around her, Antonina had to restrain a sigh. Generals. You're approaching the situation upside down, she stated. This is not really a military problem. It's political. To Ashot. Weren't you the one who was telling me just yesterday that the reason Ambrose couldn't intervene while we were suppressing the mob was because he needed the day to win over his troops? The commander of her Thracian Bucellarii nodded. She grinned. Well, he's had a day. Just how solid do you think he's made himself with his troops? Frowning. Generals. She pointed at the fortress. How long have those men, the soldiers, I mean, been stationed here? Hermogenes? The young Merarch shrugged. Years. Most of the garrison, the troops anyway, spent their entire term of service in Egypt. Even units that get called out for a campaign elsewhere are always rotated back here. That's what I thought. Now another question. Where do those men live? Not in the fortress, I'm sure. Years of service, you said. That means wives, children, families. Outside businesses, probably. Half of those soldiers, at least half, will have married into local families. They'll have invested their pay in their father-in-law's shops. Got interests in grain shipping. The whole bit, grumbled Ashot. Yeah, you're right. Fucking Garrett troopers. Always takes weeks to shake them down on a campaign. Spend the first month solid wailing about their declining property values back home. The light of understanding came, finally, to her officers. Or so at least she thought. You're right, Antonina, cried Hermogenes excitedly. That'll work. He cast eager eyes about, scanning the immediate environment of the fortress. Most of them probably live right here, right in Nicopolis. We'll start by burning everything to the ground, then find their wives and daughters, chipped in his executive officer, Callistos. Track them down wherever they are and... Won't need to, countered Ashot. Any women will do. At this distance, the garrison won't be able to make out faces anyway. Just women being stripped naked in the street with us waving our dicks around and threatening to... Antonina erupted. Stupid generals! Startled, her horse twitched. Antonina drew back on the rein savagely. Wisely, the horse froze. Cretins! Idiots! Morons! Absolute morons, the whole lot! You want me to end a small civil war by starting a big one? What the fuck is wrong with you? They shrank from her hot eyes. Antonina turned in her saddle and transferred the glare back to Menander. You. Maybe you're not too old to have lost all your wits. Maybe. How would you handle it? For a moment, Menander was too stunned to speak. Then, clearing his throat, he said, Actually, while you were talking, I was thinking about how the general... Belisarius, I mean, handled the situation with the Kushans. The second situation with the Kushans, I mean. Not the first one where we tricked Venan de Katra out of using them as guards, but the other one where he, well, they were guarding us, but they didn't know the Empress Shakuntala, I mean, not Theodora, was hidden in,
Well...
He stopped, floundering, drew a deep, shaky breath. What I mean is, I was struck by it at the time, how the general used honey instead of vinegar.
Antonina sighed, relaxed a bit.
You're promoted, she growled. Tribune Menander, you are.
Her eyes, which she now turned on her assembled officers, were no longer hot. Oh, but they were very, very cold.
Here is what you will do. You will find the wives and daughters, and the sons and fathers and mothers and brothers, and for that matter the second cousins twice removed of those soldiers forted up in that place.
Deep breath, icy cold eyes.
More precisely, you and your cataphracts will escort the Knights Hospital while they do the actual finding. You and your soldiers will stand there looking as sweet and polite as altar boys, or I'll have your guts for breakfast, while the Knights Hospital convince the soldiers' families that a potentially disastrous situation for their husbands and fathers and sons and brothers, and for that matter third cousins three times removed, would be resolved if the families would come back to their homes and reopen the shops, and most important, would cook some meals.
Cook meals? Choked Hermogenes.
A wintry smile.
Yes, meals. Big meals like the ones I remember from my days here. Spicy meals. The kind of meals you can smell a mile away.
She gazed at the fortress, still smiling. Let the soldiers smell those meals while they're chewing on their garrison biscuits. Let them think about their warm beds with their wives in them while they sleep on the battlements in full armor. Let them think about their little shops and their father-in-law's promises that they'll inherit the business while Ambrose gives speeches.
They'll never agree to it, squeaked Ashot. Their wives and daughters, I mean, and their families.
He squared his shoulders, faced Antonina bravely.
They won't come back. Not with us here. Hell, I wouldn't come down to it.
An arctic smile. That I can believe. Which is why you won't be here. Not you, not your cataphracts. Not Hermogenes, not his infantry regulars. I'll be here as a guarantee. Their own hostage, if they want to think of it that way.
What? Demanded Hermogenes. Alone?
Suddenly, Antonina's usual warm smile returned.
Alone? Of course not. What a silly idea.
My grenadiers will stay here with me, along with their wives and their children. All the officers now stared at Euphronius. The young Syrian met that gaze with his own squared shoulders, and then with a grin.
Great idea. Nobody'll worry about us raping anybody.
A shudder.
God, my wife would kill me.
Ashot turned back to Antonina. The short, muscular Armenian was practically gobbling.
What if Ambrose sallies? He demanded. Do you think your grenadiers alone can stand up to him?
Antonina never wavered. As a matter of fact, yes. Here, at least. She pointed down the thoroughfare to the fortress. We're not on an open field of battle, I shouted. There's only two ways Ambrose can come at me. He can send his men through all the little crooked side streets, and I will absolutely match my grenadiers against him in that terrain. All of the officers were shaking their heads. No cataphract in his right mind would even think of driving armored horses through that rabbit warren. Or he can come at me with a massed lance charge down that boulevard, which is what he'll do if he does anything. Down that beautiful boulevard, which is just wide enough to tempt a horseman, but not wide enough to maneuver. She bestowed a very benign, approving smile upon the boulevard in question. And yes, on that terrain, my grenadiers will turn him into sausage. She drew herself up in the saddle, sitting as tall as she could, which wasn't much, of course.
Do as I say.
Her officers hastened to obey then, with no further protest. Possibly that was due to the iron command in her voice, but possibly, just possibly, it was because when she drew herself up in the saddle, the blazing sun of Egypt reflected off her cuirass at such an angle as to momentarily blind her generals, and make a short woman seem like a giantess. By noon of the next day, the first families began trickling back into Nicopolis. Antonina was there to greet them from the pavilion she had set up in the very middle of the boulevard. The first arrivals approached her timidly, But finding that the legendary Antonina, she of the cleaver, was in person a most charming and sweet-tempered lady, they soon began to relax. By nightfall, hundreds had returned and were slowly beginning to mingle with the grenadiers. All of the Syrians could speak Greek now, even if many of them still spoke it badly, so they were able to communicate with the soldiers' families. Coptic was the native language of most of those folk, but as was universally the case in Alexandria, they were fluent in Greek as well. By morning of the day after, the soldiers' families were quite at ease with the grenadiers. True, the men were a bit scary, what with their bizarre and much-rumored new weapons, but their wives were a familiar thing, even if they were foreign Syrians, as were their children. And it is difficult, impossible, really, to be petrified by a man who is playing with his child or being nagged by his wife. By the end of that second day, half of Nicopolis's residents had returned. Antonina's presence and assurances, combined with worry over their businesses and properties, proved irresistible. On the morning of the following day, Antonina called for a feast. At her own expense, foodstuffs were purchased from all over the city. The great thoroughfare, not 300 yards from the fortress, was turned into an impromptu, gigantic, day-long picnic. As the picnic progressed, some of the wives of the garrison soldiers began to approach the fortress, calling up to their husbands. The first negotiations began, in a matter of speaking. Soldiers on the battlements began lowering baskets tied to ropes. Foodstuffs went up to relieve the tedium of garrison biscuits. With those delicious parcels went wifely words shouted from below. Scolding words in some cases, pleading words in others, downright salacious promises in not a few. Marching from her pavilion, Antonina counted every basket as a cannonball struck. Every wifely word is a sapper's mine laid. She leaned back easily in her couch, surrounded by a small horde of Nicopolis's housewives who had adopted her as their new patron saint and savored the moment. Great victories out of small ones. Generals. Ha! On the fifth day of the siege, the first real trouble began. As one of the wives approached the fortress, this had now become a daily occurrence, almost a ritual, a small crowd of officers forced their way through the mob of soldiers standing on the battlements. Threats were exchanged between officers and men. Then one of the officers angrily grabbed a soldier's bow and took it upon himself to fire an arrow at the wife standing on the street below. The arrow missed its mark badly. The startled, squawking, outraged housewife was actually in much greater danger of being struck by the next missile hurled from the walls. The officer himself, half dead before he even hit the ground 50 feet below. The shaken housewife squalled now as she was spattered by his blood. Shrieked then, covering her head and racing from the scene as 6 more officers were sent on the same fatal plunge. The rest of the day and into the night, the crowd standing outside the fortress could hear the sounds of brawling and fighting coming from within. Antonina herself, even from the pavilion's distance, could hear it clearly. By now, Antonina had relented enough to allow Ashot and Hermogenes to return to Nicopolis. Some of Hermogenes' soldiers had been allowed in as well, just enough to provide her grenadiers with an infantry bulwark in the event of a battle, but she still kept the cataphracts well out of sight. She stood in the entry of her pavilion next to her 2 officers, gauging the sounds. "It's not a full battle yet," opined Hermogenes. "Not even close," agreed Ashot. "What you're hearing is about 100 little brawls and set-tos. Ambrose is losing it completely." Hermogenes glanced sideways at Antonina. "He'll sally tomorrow. Bet on it." Ashot nodded. "He's got to. He can't let Antonina sit out here rotting his army out from under him." "How many will he still have, do you think?" she asked. Ashot shrugged. "His cataphracts, the most of them, anyway, those aren't Egyptians. They're a Greek unit from Paphlagonia, been here less than a year. They won't have much in the way of local ties, and all of their officers, down to the tribunes, were handpicked by Ambrose." He tugged his beard. 600 men, let's say. Beyond that, tug, tug. His eyes widened. "Mary, Mother of God, I think that's it." Eagerly now. "I could bring up the Thracian Fusillarii. Those fat-ass Garrett trooper shits would never have a chance. We'd..." "No." The gaze which she bestowed on Ashot wasn't icy, not in the least. The past few days, if nothing else, had restored her good temper, but it was still just as unyielding. My grenadiers, I said it would be, my grenadiers it is. Ashot sighed, but he didn't argue the point. Antonina was wearing her armor at all times now, except when she slept. True, the sun was down, but the many candles in her pavilion still shined off her cuirass, making her seem... Jesus, he thought. How can any woman have tits that big? As the night wore on, the sounds of fighting within the fortress waned. Then, at daybreak, a sudden outburst erupted, rapidly escalated to the sounds of a pitched battle. Antonina had prepared the grenadiers the night before. By the time the battle within the fortress was in full swing, Antonina was already out on the street, in armor, on horseback. Ashot and Hermogenes sat their horses alongside her. Ahead of them, drawn up and ready for battle, stood the Theodoran cohort. 300 of them were now armed with John of Rhodes' new hand cannons. The hand cannons had barrels made of welded wrought iron staves, hooped with iron bands, mounted on wooden shoulder stocks. The barrels were about 18 inches long, with a bore measuring approximately 1 inch in diameter. The guns were loaded from reed cartridges with a measured charge in one end of the tube and a fiber wad and a lead ball in the other. A hardwood ramrod recessed into the front of the stock was used to ram the charges down the barrel. The hand cannons had no trigger. The charges were ignited by a slow match, tow soaked in saltpeter, held in a pivoting clamp attached to the stock. As handheld firearms go, they were about as primitive as could be imagined. John of Rhodes had wanted to wait until he had developed a better weapon, but Belisarius had insisted on rushing these first guns into production. From experience, he had known that John would take forever to produce a gun he was finally satisfied with. The Malwa wouldn't give them that time. These would do for the moment. Primitive, the guns were. Their accuracy was laughable, and many a Bucellarii did laugh during the practice session in Rhodes, watching the Syrian gunners miss targets at a range that any self-respecting Thracian cataphract could have hit with an arrow blind drunk. But it was noticeable that none of the scoffing cataphracts offered to serve as a target, not after watching the effects of a heavy lead bullet which did happen to strike a target. Those balls could drive an inch into solid pine, and with far greater striking power than any arrow. The formation into which the cohort was drawn up was designed to take advantage of the hand cannons. Half of the gunners were arrayed at the cohort's front, in six lines stretching across the entire width of the boulevard, 25 men to a line. Squads of Hermogenes' infantry were interspersed between each line of gunners, ready to use their long pikes to hold off any cavalry who made it through the gunfire. The other 150 gunners were lining the rooftops for 50 yards down both sides of the boulevard, ready to pour their own fire onto the street below. The rest of the cohort, armed with grenades, stood in back of the gunners, their slings and bombs in hand. The sound of the fighting within the fortress seemed to be reaching a crescendo. For a moment, the gates of the fortress began to open. Then, accompanied by the steel clangor of swords on shields, swung partially shut. Christ, muttered Ashot. Now that poor bastard Ambrose has to fight his way out of the fortress. What a mess that's got to be in there. Suddenly, the gates of the fortress opened wide. Seconds later, the first of Ambrose's cataphracts began spilling out into the street. It was immediately obvious that the enemy cataphracts were totally disorganized and leaderless. That's not a sally, exclaimed Hermogenes. They're just trying to get out of the fortress. Fuck 'em, hissed Antonina. Euphronius? The cohort commander waved without even bothering to look back. The nearest cataphracts were not much more than 200 yards away, well within range for his best slingers. Slingstaffs, he bellowed. Volley! 20 grenadiers standing in the rear wound up, swirled in the peculiarly graceful way of slingers, sent the missiles on their way. His best grenadiers, those 20, with the most proficient fuse-cutting wives. Only 3 of the grenades fell short. None fell wide. Only 2 burst too late. None too soon. The crowd of cataphracts jostling their way out of the fortress, perhaps 400 by now, were ripped by 15 grenades bursting in their midst. Then, a moment or so later, by the belated explosions of the 2 whose fuses had been cut over long. The casualties among the cataphracts themselves were fairly light, in truth. Their heavy armor, designed to fend off Dagon lances and axes, were almost impervious to the light shrapnel of grenades. And while that armor provided little protection against concussion, a man had to be very close to a grenade blast in order to be killed by the pure force of the explosion itself. But their horses. The armor worn by the cavalry mounts was even heavier, but it was concentrated entirely on their heads, chests, and withers. The grenades, especially the ones which exploded near the ground, shattered their legs and spilled their intestines, and, most of all, threw even the unwounded beasts into a frenzied terror. Ambrose's cataphracts had been nothing but a mob, anyway. Now they were simply a mob desperately trying to get out of the line of fire. More cataphracts piled out of the gates, adding to the confusion. Another volley sailed their way. More horses were butchered. Another volley of grenades landed in their midst. Ambrose's loyalists dissolved completely then. There was no thought of anything but personal safety. Breaking up into small groups, or simply as individuals, the cataphracts raced their horses down the streets of Nicopolis. Going where? Who knows? Just somewhere else. Anywhere else. Anywhere common soldiers weren't rising in mutiny. Anywhere grenades didn't rupture their bodies. Anywhere the hot sun of Egypt didn't blind them, glancing off the great brass tits of a giantess. Anywhere else. Antonina captured the would-be emperor 2 days later, in a manner of speaking. After negotiating safe passage, a small group of Ambrose's subordinates rode up to the prefectural palace where Antonina now made her headquarters, accompanied by perhaps a dozen cataphracts, and a corpse wrapped in a linen shroud. Ambrose, it was. The former commander of the army of Egypt had been stabbed in the back several times.
He made us do it. Loyal Romans we are, honest. He made us do it. And we'll never do it again, neither. Never, 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 never. We promise.
Antonina let it pass. She even welcomed the loyal officers back into the ranks of the army of Egypt. Reduced in rank, naturally. But even that punishment she sweetened, partly with an explanation that room needed to be made for the new officers whom the new commander had brought with him, mostly with a peroration on the subject of the future riches of Roman soldiers from Malwa booty. The officers made no complaint. They were glad enough not to be hanged. The only grumbling at her lenient treatment of Ambrose's cataphracts, ironically enough, came from the other soldiers in his army. They were disgruntled that the same louts they had battled in the fortress, the stinking bums who had threatened their wives, even shot arrows at one of them, were let off so lightly. They didn't do more than grumble, and rather quietly at that. Their own position, after all, was a bit precarious. Best to let bygones be bygones, all things considered. Someone, of course, had to pay the bill. Ambrose himself being dead, which didn't stop Antonina from hanging his corpse and leaving it to sway in the wind from the fortress's battlements, the bill was presented to Paul and the former prefect. Both men had been found, after the cataphracts fled, huddling in one of the fortress's chambers. Paul still defiant, the prefect blubbering for mercy. Antonina hanged the prefect immediately. His body swayed in the wind at the great intersection at the center of the city, suspended by one of the tetrastylon pillars. Paul. No martyrs, she pronounced, waving down the bloodthirsty chorus coming from all her advisors except Theodosius. An executed prefect is just a dead politician. Nobody gives a damn except his cronies, and they won't grieve for more than a day. A religious leader, on the other hand. She straightened in the chair which, for all intents and purposes, served as her throne in the audience chamber of the prefectural palace. Officially, of course, authority was in the hands of the new prefect. In the real world, he was standing in the crowd before her, one among many. Her officers almost winced, seeing that erect, chest-swelling motion. But there was no blinding flash this time. Antonina had stopped wearing her cuirass. Just the firm posture of a small woman. Voluptuous, true, but no giantess. Not that the sight of that familiar, very female form led them to think they could oppose her will. Giantess or no, brass tits or no, on that matter the question was settled. Seated on her throne, Antonina decreed, "No martyrs." Theodosius sighed with relief. Seeing the little movement, Antonina turned her gaze onto him.
"What do you recommend, Patriarch?"
she asked, smiling now. "A long stay on the island of Palmeria, perhaps? Tending goats for the next 15 or 20 years?
"Excellent idea," exclaimed Theodosius. Piously, "It's good for the soul, that sort of simple manual labor. Everyone knows it. It's a constant theme in the best sermons."
Off to Palmeria, then, Paul went, the very same day. Antonina saw him off personally, stood on the dock until his ship was under sail. He was still defiant, Paul was. Cursed her for a whore and a harlot all the way to the dock, all the way out to his transport, and from the very stern of the ship which took him to his exile. Antonina, throughout, simply responded with a sweet smile, until his ship was halfway to the horizon. Then, and only then, did the smile fade, replaced by a frown.
"I feel kind of guilty about this," she admitted.
Standing next to her, Ashok was startled.
"About Paul? I think that bastard's lucky."
"Not him," she snorted. "I was thinking about the poor goats."
Chapter 35. The Euphrates, autumn 531 AD.
"So where's your flank attack?" demanded Morris. "You remember, the one you predicted was going to happen that very night, about a week ago?"
Belisarius shrugged. Reclining comfortably against the crude rock wall of one of the artillery towers on the dam, he returned Morris's glower with a look of complacence.
"I forgot about the negotiations," he explained. "What negotiations?"
Belisarius stuck his thumb over his shoulder, pointing southwest. "The ones that Ormazd has been having with the Malwa these past few days." He reached down and brought a goblet to his lips, sipping from its contents. Morris eyed the goblet with disfavor.
"How can you drink that stuff? You're starting to go native on me, I can tell. A Roman, sure as hell a Thracian, should be drinking wine, not that Persian."
Belisarius smiled crookedly. "I find fresh water flavored with lemon and pomegranate used to be quite refreshing, Morris. I thank Beresmenus for introducing me to it." He levered himself into an upright position. "Besides," he added, "if I drank wine all day, day after day, stuck on this misbegotten dam, I'd be a complete sot by now."
"Anastasius and Valentinian drink wine," came the immediate riposte. "Ever noticed them stumbling about?"
Belisarius cast a cold eye on his two bodyguards not 4 yards away. Like Belisarius, Anastasius and Valentinian were lounging in the shade provided by the artillery tower.
"With his body weight," growled the general, "Anastasius could drink a ton of wine a day and never notice."
Anastasius, hearing, looked down at his immense frame with philosophical serenity.
"And as for Valentinian, the man not only looks like a weasel, he can eat and drink like one too."
Valentinian, hearing, looked down at his whipcord body with his own version of philosophical serenity, which, more than anything, resembled a weasel after gorging itself in a chicken coop. Suddenly, Belisarius thrust himself to his feet. The motion was pointless, really. It simply expressed the general's frustration at the past week of immobility. Stuck on a dam with his army while they fought it out day after day with an endless series of Malwa probes and attacks. For all practical purposes, the battle had become a siege. Belisarius was a master of siegecraft, whether on offense or defense, but it was a type of warfare that he personally detested. His temperament led him to favor maneuver rather than simple mayhem. He hadn't even had the, so to speak, relief of personal combat. On the first day after joining his army on the dam itself, Belisarius had started to participate directly in repelling one of the Malwa attacks. Even before Anastasius and Valentinian had corralled him and dragged him away, the Syrian soldiers manning that section of the wall had fiercely driven him off. Liberius and Morris, riding up with their cataphracts to bolster the Syrians, had even cursed him for a damned fool. The general's cold and calculating brain recognized the phenomenon, of course, and took satisfaction in it. Only commanders who were genuinely treasured by an army had their personal safety so jealously guarded by their own soldiers. But the man inside the general had chafed, and cursed, and stormed, and railed. The general bridled the man. And so for a week, Belisarius had reconciled himself to the inevitable. He had never again attempted to directly participate in the fight at the wall, but he had spent each and every day riding up and down the Roman line of fortifications, encouraging his soldiers, consulting with his officers, organizing the logistics, and especially spending time with the wounded. Valentinian and Anastasius had grumbled. Aid had chafed. Rockets, very dangerous. But Belisarius had been adamant. His soldiers, he knew, might take conscious satisfaction in the knowledge that their commander was out of the direct fray. But they would, at a much, much deeper human level, take heart and courage from his immediate presence. In that, he had been proven right. As the week wore on, his army's battle cry underwent a transformation. Rome, Rome, it had been in the first 2 days. By the third day, as he rode up and down the fortifications, his own name had been cheered. That was still true, even more so, a week after the battle started. But his name was no longer being used as a simple cheer. It had become a taunt of defiance hurled at the enemy. The entire Roman army using that single word to let the Malwa know, you sorry bastards are fucked. Fucked. Belisarius. Belisarius. Belisarius drained his goblet and set it down on the wall with enough force to crack the crude pottery. He ignored the sound, swiveling his head to the west. His eyes glared. It being late afternoon, the sun promptly glared back. He raised a hand to shield his face. Come on, Ormazd, he growled. Make up your mind. Not even a god-be-damned Aryan prince should need a week to decide on treason. Morris turned his own head to follow Belisarius' gaze. You think that's what's been going on?
Count on it, Morris, said Belisarius softly. I can guarantee you that every night for the past week, Malwa emissaries have been shuttling back and forth between Ormazd's pavilion and...
For a moment he began to turn his head to the south. Squinting fiercely, as if by sheer force of will he could peer into the great pavilion which the Malwa had erected on the left bank of the Euphrates well over a mile away. The pavilion where, he was certain, Link exercised its demonic command. Morris grunted sourly.
Maybe you're right. I sure as hell hope so. If this damn siege goes on much longer, we'll... Ah.
He made a vague gesture with his hand as if brushing dung off his tunic. Belisarius said nothing. He knew Morris wasn't worried that the Malwa could take the dam by frontal assault. Nor was the Kiliarch really concerned that the Malwa could wear out the Romans. The steady stream of barges coming down from Callinicum kept the defenders better supplied than the attackers. The Romans could withstand this kind of semi-siege almost indefinitely. But it was wearing. Wearing on the body, wearing on the nerves. Since the ferocious Malwa assaults of the first day and night, which they had suspended in favor of constant probes and quick pinprick attacks, casualties had been relatively light. But light casualties are still casualties. Men you know, dead, crippled, wounded, day after day with no end in sight.
I hope you're right, he repeated, sourly.
Belisarius decided a change of subject was in order. Agathius is going to live, he announced. I'm quite confident of it now. I saw him just yesterday. Morris glanced upriver at the ambulance barges moored just beyond the range of the Malwa rockets.
Glad to hear it. I thought sure.
He lapsed into another little grunt. Not sour, this one. The inarticulate sound combined admiration with disbelief.
Never thought he'd make it, he admitted, especially after he refused to go to Callinicum.
Belisarius nodded. Most of the Roman casualties after triage had been shipped back to Callinicum, but Agathius had flatly refused, had even threatened violence when Belisarius tried to insist. So he had stayed, as had his young wife. Sudaba had been just as stubborn toward Agathius' demands that she leave as he had been toward Belisarius, including the threats of violence. In truth, Belisarius was grateful. Cyril had succeeded to the command of the Constantinople troops and had done very well in the post. But Agathius's stance had done wonders for the army's morale, and by no means simply among the Greeks. For the past week, a steady stream of soldiers, Thracians, Syrians, Illyrians, and Arabs, as much as Greeks, had visited the maimed officer on his barge. Agathias was very weak from tremendous loss of blood and in great pain, what with one leg amputated at the knee and the other at the ankle. But the man had borne it all with a stoicism which would have shamed Marcus Aurelius, and had never failed to take the occasion to reinforce his visitor's determination to resist the Malwa. A quiet thought came from Aid. Think where man's glory most begins and ends, and say my glory was I had such friends. Yes, whispered Belisarius. Yes, it's from a poet whose name will be Yeats, many centuries from now. Belisarius took a deep breath. Let us give mankind those centuries then, and all the millions of centuries which will come after. Chapter 36. In its pavilion, at the very moment when Belisarius made that silent vow, the thing from the future which called itself Link made its catastrophic mistake. It had calculated the possibilities, analyzed the odds, gauged the options. Most of all, it had assessed the capabilities of the enemy commander so accurately and so correctly, and in so many ways, that Belisarius would have been stunned had he ever known how well he had been measured. Measured, however, only as a general, for that was all that Link understood. The being from the future, with its superhuman intelligence, had burrowed to the depths of the crooked mind of Belisarius, down to the very tips of the roots, and had missed the man completely.
Ormazd has agreed, then.
Link's top subordinates, four officers squatting on cushions before the chair which held the shape of an old woman, nodded in unison. Yes, great Lady Holy, said one. He will pull his troops out of position 3 hours after sundown. Link pondered, gauged, calculated, analyzed, assessed the crooked, cunning brain of the great General Belisarius. From long experience, the four officers sat silently throughout. It never occurred to them to offer any advice. The advice would not have been welcome, and if Link had none of the explosive temper of the late Lord Jivita, the being was utterly merciless. The officers weren't especially afraid of the huge, tulwar-bearing men who squatted between them and the great Lady Holy. Those were simply guards, but they had only to turn their heads to see the line of silent assassins who waited, as motionless as statues, in the rear of the pavilion. Link, great Lady Holy, had used those assassins 3 times since the expedition began, to punish failure twice, but there had also been an officer who couldn't learn to restrain his counsel. Finally, Link spoke.
There is a possibility. It is not likely. Were the enemy led by another commander, I would dismiss it out of hand. But I cannot. Not with Belisarius.
Silence followed again for well over a minute. The Malwa officers didn't ask for an explanation of those cryptic words. None would have been given if they had. Gauged, analyzed, assessed, made its decision.
Send the Kushans first. All of them. On foot.
The officers were visibly startled now. After a moment, one of them ventured to ask,
On foot?
Silence. The officer cleared his throat.
But, great Lady Holy, it is essential that the maneuver be made with great speed. Belisarius will realize what we're doing by sunrise at the latest, quite possibly earlier. It's almost impossible, even with the harshest orders, to keep such a large body of men from making some noise, and we have no control over the Persians in any event.
Another interjected, We must get the flanking column upriver as fast as possible, so that they can ford the Euphrates before Belisarius can block their way. That requires cavalry, Great Lady Holy.
Be silent. I understand your argument, but there is a possibility if Belisarius is cunning enough. I cannot take the chance. The Yetai, after they cross, can race upriver to seize the bridgehead. The regular cavalry following can bring the Kushan's horses with them, They should still be able to reach the Yetai in time to hold the crossing.
The officers submitted, of course, but one of them, bolder than the rest, made a last protest.
It will take the Kushans so much time if they cross the river on foot.
That is precisely the point. Now do as I command.
All opposition fled. The officers hastened from the pavilion, spreading the command throughout the great army and camped below the dam. Alone in its pavilion, Link continued to calculate, gauge, analyze. Its thoughts were confident. Link was guided not simply by its own incredible intellect, but also by intelligence, in the military sense of the term. Roman prisoners had been taken here and there in the days of fighting, interrogated. Those of them with personal knowledge of Belisarius had been questioned under torture, until Link was satisfied that it had squeezed every last item necessary to fully assess the capabilities of its enemy. It would have done better, had it been in Link's power, to have interrogated a Persian survivor of the Battle of Minduas, the man named Beresmenus. But perhaps not. Link would not have asked the right questions, and Beresmenus would certainly not have volunteered the information, not even under the knife. But he could have. He could have. He could have warned the Malwa superbeing that mercy can have its own sharp point, keener than any lance or blade, and even deadlier to the foe. Chapter 37. Finally, hissed Belisarius. The general was practically dancing with impatience, waiting for his horse to be brought up to the artillery tower where he had made his headquarters for the past week. He was already in full armor. He'd begun donning the gear the moment he heard the first Katyusha volleys. As he had predicted, the Malwa were attempting to cross the Nahar Malka on a pontoon bridge. He was convinced that the maneuver was a feint, but like all well-executed diversions, it carried real substance behind it. Thousands of Malwa troops were involved in the crossing, supported by most of their rocket troughs. And now, an hour into the battle, the scene to the east was a flashing cacophony. Katyusha rockets crossed trails with Malwa missiles. The Syrian soldiers on the rock pile added their own volleys of fire arrows, aimed at the boats on the canal. The Nahar Malka was lit up by those flaming ships. In the darkness ahead, he could make out the looming shape of his horse. Morris, he realized, was the man holding it. How long ago, were his first words. He could barely make out Morris's shrug.
Who's to know? The Persians are being damn quiet. Much quieter than I would have expected from a lot of headstrong Dagans. But Abu's scouts report that they've already moved out at least half of their forces, due west into the desert.
Sourly. Just as you predicted.
Belisarius nodded.
We've some time, then. Is Abu...
Norris snorted.
Be serious, of course he's in position. The old Arab goat's even twitchier than you are.
As Anastasius heaved him into the saddle, Belisarius grunted.
I am not twitchy, simply eager to close with the foe.
Close with the foe, mimicked Morris, clambering onto his own mount.
My, aren't we flowery tonight.
Securely in his saddle, Belisarius grinned. It was obvious that the prospect of action, finally, had completely restored his spirits.
Let's to it, Morris. I do believe the time has come to reacquaint the Malwa with the first law of battle.
He tugged on the reins, turning his horse. The enemy has arrived, and I intend to fuck them up completely.
What? He demanded.
Morris took a breath.
You heard me. Abu's courier reports that they're sending the Kushans across first. On foot, all of them. They even dismounted the Kushan cavalry. They've got their Yetai battalions massed on the bank, mounted, but they aren't crossing yet. Behind them, Abu thinks they're forming up Kshatriya and Malwa regulars, but he's not sure. He can't get close enough.
Belisarius turned and stared into the darkness, raising himself up in the stirrups in order to peer over the wall. He was on the road at the eastern end of the dam, just behind the front fortifications. For a moment, he plucked at his telescope, but left off the motion almost as soon as it started. He already knew that the device was no help. It was a moonless night, and the Malwa crossing the almost empty riverbed were a mile south of the dam. He could see nothing, not even with his aid-enhanced vision.
Kushan's first and without horses, he murmured. That makes no sense at all. He scratched his chin. Unless what? Hissed Morris. Scratched his chin. Unless that thing is even smarter than I thought. Morris shook his head. Stop being so damn clever. Maybe they want to make sure they don't make any noise crossing the Euphrates. Kushans on foot will be as silent as any army could be. Belisarius nodded slowly. That's possible. It's even possible that they made arrangements with Armaz to have horses left for them. Still, a little noise drew their attention. An Arab courier was trotting toward them from the western end of the dam.
Abu says now, the scout exclaimed as soon as he drew up. Almost all the Kushans are in the riverbed. At least 8,000 of them. Probably all of them by now. Their first skirmishers will have already reached the opposite bank.
Belisarius scratched his chin. God damn it to hell, snarled Morris. What are you waiting for? We can't let those men cross, General. After all our casualties, we don't have much better than 8,000 left ourselves. Once they get on dry land on the south bank, they can ford upstream any one of a dozen places. We'll have to face them on...
Enough, Morris.
The Kiliar clamped shut his jaws. Scratched the chin. The general thought, gauged, calculated, assessed. The man decided. His crooked smile came. He said very firmly, Let the Kushans cross. All of them. To the scout, Tell Abu to send up the rocket when the Yetai are almost across. And tell that old maniac to make sure he's clear first. Do you understand? I want him clear. The Arab grinned. He will be clear, General. By a hair, of course, but he will be clear. An instant later, the man was gone. Belisarius turned back to Morris. The grizzled veteran was glaring at him. Look at it this way, Belisarius said pleasantly. I've just given you what you treasure most. Something else to be morose about. Glaring furiously. To one side, Valentinian muttered, Oh, great. Just what we needed. 8,000 Kushans to deal with. Belisarius ignored both the glare and the mutter. He began to scratch his chin, but stopped. He had made his decision and would stick with it. It was a bad decision, perhaps. It might even in the end prove to be disastrous. But he thought of men who liked to gamble when they had nothing to gamble with except humor. And he remembered most of all a man with an iron face. A hard man who had in two lives and two futures made the same soft decision. A decision which, Belisarius knew, that man would always make in every life and every future. He relaxed then, confident not in his decision, but in his soul. Let them pass, he murmured. Let them pass. He cocked his head slightly. Basil's ready? Be serious, growled Morris. Belisarius smiled. A minute later, he cocked his head again. Everyone's clear? He asked. Be serious, growled Morris. Everybody except us, hissed Valentinian. We're the only ones left. The last Syrians cleared off 5 minutes ago. Let's be off then, said Belisarius cheerfully. As he and his three cataphracts walked their horses off the dam, moving carefully in the dark, Belisarius began softly reciting verses. The men with him didn't recognize the poem. There was no way they could have. Aid had just given it to him from the future. That future which Belisarius would shield from men who thought themselves gods. Those masterful images, because complete, grew in pure mind, but out of what began. I must lie down where all the ladders start, in the foul rag and bone shop of the heart. Chapter 38. The moment the signal rocket exploded, Link knew. Its four top officers, standing nearby on the platform of the command tower overlooking the river, were simply puzzled. The rocket, after bursting, continued to burn like a flare as it sailed down onto the mass of soldiers struggling their way across the bed of the Euphrates. Yetai, in the main, swearing softly as they tried to guide their horses in the darkness through a morass of streamlets and mucky sinkholes.
But there were at least 5,000 Malwa regulars also, including a train of rocket carts and the Kshatriya to man them. The flare burned, the officers stared and puzzled. But Link knew at once, understood how completely it had been outwitted, although it did not, then or ever, understand how Belisarius had done it. But the being from the future was not given to cursing or useless self-reproach. It recognized only necessity. It didn't even wait for the first thundering sound of the explosions to give the order to its assassins. Across the entire length of the dam blocking the Euphrates, the charges erupted. Almost in slow motion, the boulder-laden ships which formed the base of the dam heaved up. The sound of the eruption was huge but muffled, and there was almost no flash given off. The charges, for all their immensity, had been deeply buried. Even Link, with its superhuman vision, could barely see the disaster, in the faint light still thrown off by the signal flare. The officers saw nothing, then or ever. The first assassin's knife plunged into the back of the first officer, severing his spinal cord. A split second later, the other three died with him, still staring at the rocket, still puzzled. Link had failed, but its failure would remain hidden. Its reputation was essential to the Malwa cause, and the cause of the new gods who had created Malwa. The officers would take the blame. The mass of soldiers in the bed of the Euphrates, perhaps 14,000 in all, froze at the sound, turned, stared into the darkness, puzzled. The night was dark and the dam was a mile away. They too could see nothing, but the noise was ominous. Then the first breeze came, and the smartest of the trapped soldiers understood. Shrieking, cursing, even sabering the slower-witted men who barred their way, they made a desperate attempt to scramble their horses out of the riverbed. The rest... The wall of water which smote the Malwa army came like a mace wielded by a god. Untold tons of hurtling water, carrying great boulders as if they were chips of wood. Smashing in the sides of the old riverbed, gouging channels as it came, ripping new